Hello, TSLP listener. This is Dustin with a brief message to let you know that this episode was massive. It was over 3 hours long, and we felt like that was really long for a single podcast episode. So we split it into two parts. Part one, we're going to be talking mostly about the movie The Shining. And then part two, we'll talk mostly about Room 237, the sequel Dr. Sleep, the miniseries, all that sort of related materials that aren't exactly the movie itself. That will drop later this week. So just want to give you a heads up. This is not technically a full episode, so you'll get the second part a little later on. But hope you enjoy it. I am Dustin Ghost of Hollywood.
And I'm JT Kelly.
And this is the Silver Linings Playlist, or I should say, a Spooky Linings Playlist, the podcast that tries to find the silver lining in some of cinema's scariest endings. This is it. This is the season 4 finale, episode 104 of the Silver Linings Playlist. This is our last one before we go on hiatus for the year. And this is monumental. This is an episode I've been wanting to do forever. This is a powerhouse of a movie, and it's going to be just as much of an episode. But a little bit of business up front, you just heard not Mally Moore introduce himself. You heard, in fact, previous guest JT Kelly, who's joining me this week. Mally, unfortunately, could not be available for this episode. He died. Mally actually has a good problem to have. He is working a lot, which is great considering – you know, he's in the film industry, and of course, the film industry got hit pretty hard with COVID.
Oh my gosh, yeah. But, good for Mally.
He wasn't available, unfortunately, to tear himself away from his work to join us on this episode. So, JT, thank you for filling in as a last-minute replacement. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you gave me a lot of homework for 2 days.
Yeah.
An absolute
for those who don't know, this whole season, we were really good about being ahead of schedule in terms of recording. Like, we had episodes banked, ready to go, so we wouldn't have any issues. And then, of course, on the finale, we're recording this only like 2 days before it comes out. So this is it's crazy how this schedule turned out. But we're here. We're finally doing it. I couldn't have picked a better co-host. I mean, you're one of my favorite people in the world. This is one of my favorite movies.
Yes. So, okay. Yeah. So this. Yeah. I was about to ask that if this is or close to your favorite horror movie or one of the top favorites. I've known that about you, and when you gave me this homework, I'm like stressing. I was like, I've been a footnote on this podcast, and you're giving me this slot on this movie. I kind of went overboard with the notes.
Oh, I did too.
I have no idea how often y'all use or how many notes you guys have. I have about 4 or 5 pages because I needed filler. I needed. I wanted to burn some ammo. Yeah.
Normally, I'm like a 1 to 2 page guy. I don't want to say how many I have for this one because I don't want to scare the listener. But let's just say it's going to be a lot. yes, to answer your question, though, this is probably my favorite movie, like full stop. Like, I feel like anybody that knows me knows how much I love this movie. It's weird because, you know, one of the first things we like to do is we like to talk about what our relationship is with this movie. I can't tell you the first time I saw it. I was
about to flip the script on you and say, well, Dustin, on this podcast, we usually like to talk about our relationship with this movie. But I've never thought about it. I never thought about asking that ever. Okay, I know it's your favorite movie, but what
this was is it, so like, strange, I got to say, first of all, Mally never asked questions to me. He never asked.
Well, see, I feel so like I need to because this is your movie. You know, I like The Shining just as much as the next guy, but I mean, this is your thing. So during the rewatch, I was like, I got to ask about this, this, and this. But you can't remember the first time you've seen this movie?
No, I tell Mally this all the time whenever we're talking about movies on the show. From like age 16 to like 19, I was on a huge tear to just watch every movie I could. And this was one of those movies when I was really starting to get into Kubrick. But I can't recall the first time. It's so crazy. I've seen this movie countless times, and I even had the pleasure of seeing it last year on the big screen for the first time in a 4K restoration right before Dr. Sleep came out, and it was amazing.
I'm glad something like that's starting to like take hold, is showing older movies mm-hmm. in theaters, mm-hmm. especially right now where a lot of movies aren't coming out. Either they've been delayed or stuff like that. I think recently here in Little Dothan, I think The Goonies was playing in theaters.
That's pretty cool.
Drive-in
theaters and stuff too.
Yeah,
like have really made a killing off these local drive-ups.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Actually, ours, our local drive-in theater closed, and then someone saw a gold mine and opened it back up, and it's back up playing movies now.
I don't know why drive-in movie theaters like completely fell off like that. I mean, it is such a niche thing, but like it's also easy to do. Like it's an easy thing. You get the comfort of being in your own car. I mean, I get. Also, the benefits of being in a theater, but like some movies just really lend themselves to, I would say, a drive-in experience. Like especially a lot of kids movies and stuff, you know.
Yes,
like kids older kids movies would
like,
be great.
Especially like double feature things. Like I would, yes, that's a
or
for
like
kids,
the cheesy '80s horror movies too. Like the old Friday the 13th and stuff would be great for a drive-in theater.
Yeah, it would
super
now,
spooky.
The one thing, the only problem I have with drive-in theaters is the audio. I mean, your audio is only as good as your car radio. So, yep.
And you're not getting true like 7.1 or 5.1 even really.
Yeah,
or you're getting stereo. So,
but you're right. Just for a campy like movies that are old movies that you've already seen. That's
mm-hmm.
you want to have that experience. See them on the big screen. It seems really fun.
Yeah,
I'm glad
not,
people are doing
it. It's not
it.
Ideal for I'd say new movies you haven't seen before. But if you've seen it, it's you're familiar with it. Definitely a drive-in would be great. Well, JT, since you know, we had you on the show recently with Halloween. It only makes sense to have you back for The Shining because it's such a crazy distance between those two movies and even, you know, all the other horror movies we've done on the show. We don't really cover a lot of prestige horror movies. So this is an interesting one to do, especially for our finale. What was your relationship with this movie? When was the first time you saw it? How did it hold up on this rewatch? And, you know, what this movie has a lot going for it that's not just the movie. Like there's, you know, Room 237, there's all the conspiracy theories.
Yes.
Like what's your whole history with The Shining?
I have my dear mother to thank for this movie. Me and her, we were, I was, had to have been 8, 9 around there. I was completely turned off from scary movies. Yeah.
Too young.
I was completely turned off from scary movies because I watched Halloween, and Halloween, it literally gave me night terrors and it stressed me out. So I didn't watch scary movies. I walk in, my mom is a super Stephen King fan, Dean Koontz. Like she's a reader. She reads, she likes the adaptations, but I don't know.
Yeah.
This movie.
Mally's mom had a similar thing. Like, she really loved the horror Stephen King. And I think he even told me the miniseries, The Shining miniseries, was like huge in his house. So this movie was, I have
mom
to assume,
hated
also
it.
A part of that.
Mom hated it. Actually, yeah. Dude, you'd be proud of this moment. I actually called her today to be like, hey, I forgot to tell you this, but I'm going to be on a podcast with us today. We're talking about The Shining. And she's like, oh, really? And I was like, yeah. And we were talking about. We're talking about Jack Nicholson. She's like, yeah, that other guy that played in that other remake or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. I just didn't like that one. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, it was just awful. Like,
it's real bad.
Like, yes. But even like I was going over stuff like, she's like, well, what are you taking notes about it for? Like, don't you just talk about it? And I kind of gave her a couple notes that I had. And she's like, oh, yeah. And another thing, like with mirrors and stuff. And I'll get into that in a moment. But mm-hmm. I was like, all right, Mom. Like, you want to hop on? Like, what are you doing later?
I would love to have Mama Kelly on the podcast.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
My mom sat me down and let me watch this with her because she said there's no, like, it's not like a serial killer. It's not a slasher. It's just kind of spooky and stuff like that. And
mm-hmm.
so it was scary in the sense of, yeah, I was terrified of it, but it was scary in the sense of I'm looking at something and I'm terrified versus it just jumping out like a mm-hmm. lot of slashers are.
Mm-hmm.
And I thoroughly had a good time with it. Me and Mom talked about it afterwards, and it's just been something we've watched plenty of times before. On this rewatch, I think since the last time I watched it, thanks to you guys getting me into movies, way back in the day, I guess I noticed a lot more things than I normally wouldn't as a casual viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to get in a lot of that as far as a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, a lot of the stuff that if you blink, you miss it, or if you didn't have that trained eye, you wouldn't notice it. Yeah, but absolutely. And, of course, it's The Shining. Of course, it held up. It absolutely... Right. I had to break it up for work reasons and split it up, but some things I didn't realize what was going on from back then that I know what's going on now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was definitely worth a rewatch.
So I want to go back to something you mentioned, because I had a similar experience. Would you say Halloween is probably your favorite horror franchise, right?
See.
I know you're a huge Michael Myers fan.
Yes, I'm a huge Michael Myers fan. I'm going to have to say yes, because it holds a special place. Is it the best or the most consistent franchise?
Right.
No, unfortunately.
But you said you saw that at like a young age, and like in later in your life, it became like the thing that you attracted yourself to. I had a similar experience with the first horror movie I saw at way too young an age. I think I was like 8 or 9, like you. I saw the original Dawn of the Dead, 1978, ooh, I believe. And I was way too young to be seeing it. And I was with my brother, who's 4 years older than me, and his friends. And I had to play like I wasn't scared. But at the first zombie bite in that apartment building that's being swarmed by the police at the beginning, you see him bite his wife and the flesh tearing out of her neck. And it's like orange blood. And it was so horrifying.
Old Tom Savini, right?
Tom Savini doing the makeup, I believe, on that one too. Yeah,
I think he played in it too, right? Like he's the biker dude.
Yeah, he's the leader of the biker gang. But no, that movie now is like one of my. It's easily top 5 favorite horror movies, and maybe even like my top 10 of all time movies. That like Dawn of the Dead, the original, is so fucking amazing. And it's weird that like you latch onto those things that you were so horrified once.
Yes,
as a kid.
Okay, like, so like to me, you know, like we're gonna throw out the big heavy hitters, you know. Jason and Freddy, yeah, they're scary, but Freddy's like supernatural. I was never scared of supernatural, and never got me. Jason,
me too.
Jason in the first 2 movies, like his mom and him, yeah, that's scary. But when he starts like regenerating body parts, I'm like, okay, you're not scary anymore.
Yeah,
Leatherface is pretty terrifying, I think.
Leatherface is, yeah, I missed the whole Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street train. I didn't see those until I was older, and it had no real effect on me. Leatherface, you know, is, I think, just something inherently terrifying about a chainsaw in general.
So, in perspective, I think, Michael Myers being the most realistic, right? Like, he escaped lunatic, he silently stalks and kills people. Like,
yeah,
most realistic. And realistic is scary. Realistic scared me. In terms, he's just a man in a one-on-one. You could fist fight him and win, or you can obviously outrun him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so there's a sense of a survivability. I can get away from this.
Yeah.
Personally, not just anybody, but personally, I can get away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. If I was like, I don't know what you call it, the house, the woods around the house, his entire family, I know I'm not going to survive. Like, I don't know.
Especially, like, I know a lot of people don't like it, but I really liked that 2003 remake.
2003, yes. I'm glad you
said
that.
So good. Like, the guy playing Leatherface there is sprinting with a chainsaw. It's horrifying.
Yes.
I mean, he's sprinting in the original, too, but, like, I don't know. That, yeah, Leatherface always got me. Like, the Romero of the Dead's got me. But bringing it back to The Shining, like you mentioned, the realism, like this movie is filled with the supernatural, but essentially you boil it down to it's man versus man, essentially man versus woman.
Right.
It's just a guy with an axe.
I kind of had a sense as I was getting all this together. Cause we're going to talk about Room 237 later, but each of these individual people talking about it, they talked about what they think it was about, whether it be Indian genocide or the Holocaust. And again, this is a very ground level, what I was get the vibes I was getting, I guess. Mm-hmm. Especially when he was locked in the pantry and stuff. It seemed like his macho was being tested. And let me explain. So the American dream, you know, got the husband that works hard to provide for his family. You got the wife that stays at home, takes care of the kids, stuff like that. It's that, but in the absolute worst way possible. The worst, mm-hmm. It's like the American nightmare. It's
the destruction of the nuclear family. Like, it's, yes,
okay.
It's not the rose-colored glasses looking back in the 50s of man goes to work, woman provides. Like, we're done with that.
And what I kind of got from it was he was teaching. He got this new job, better opportunity. So he feels like it's something that he's worked hard for. And he's here mm-hmm. now, and it's his responsibility. That's his duty, I guess.
Yeah.
And then, like, for example, the first time Wendy came in and interrupted him from writing and stuff, and he went apeshit. He finally got back to writing from a writer's block, and she ruined it. He got upset.
Yeah.
Okay. And then later on in the pantry, and I'm not going to go into too much detail, I guess he's getting made fun of, pretty much getting called a coward, saying, like, we don't think you have the stomach to kill your family.
Yeah.
Like, and all this stuff. And he's being challenged, and he's like, as soon as I get out of here, he doesn't even realize what he needs to prove. He doesn't realize that he's trying to prove himself by killing his family. He's just trying to prove himself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this movie, this is the reason I love Kubrick. This movie can be interpreted in so many different ways depending on how you're feeling at any given time. Like, it could be a tale of toxic masculinity. It could be a tale of isolationism and what that does to the primal senses in a person. It could be, like you said, it could be a tale about writer's block. It can be a tale of anything you need it to be, and you can fit that mold. I think that's what separates most directors from, you know, just the run-of-the-mill blockbusters, is they have a way of making things fit to not just one allegory. Like, it's weird because, you know, I watch this movie, and depending on my mood, it changes how I see the movie. Like, if I'm in a good mood, I'll sit down and watch this movie, and I can laugh at it. Like, this movie can be unintentionally hilarious at times. And even seeing it in the theater, when I saw it in the theater, the crowd and that I was with, we had a great time laughing at parts that maybe we shouldn't be laughing at, but it's all dependent on how you're feeling in that moment. Because if I'm also in a bad mood, I can look at this movie and be terrified.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
even you can just knowing what's coming around
and
corner.
Depressed and just, yeah. Yeah. And I was, because funny you say that, I had to split this up between two different nights. Mm-hmm. One of them was after a 10-hour shift, and then one of them was this morning on my day off. Mm-hmm. Two different feelings. Like, I just, like, yeah. Working 10 hours, I sit down, I'm so tired, I got to start this. You know what I mean? Like, it's, yeah, you're exactly right. But which, that's what, again, we're going to talk about Kubrick, and that's how it makes him genius. Kubrick's known for, like, oh, well, that was just an accident. No, that he did everything on, there's pictures of him placing products, like, in the background, like, moving them for a reason. Okay, which it also makes you want to think, like, yo, how many of that was actually planned, and how much he's like, hey, let's just throw all this shit at the wall and see what sticks.
Well, that's the one thing that it's unfortunate about not just this movie, but Kubrick as his whole filmography and his legacy as a director, is he's not around anymore to, you know, clear things up. So it's really frustrating. Like, I rewatched Room 237 in preparation for this episode, and that documentary is a pile of dog shit. Like, 9 out of 10 things that they're, you know, spouting in that documentary is full, utter bullshit. It does have a few things that, like, you know, it makes you, like, raise your eyebrows. Or
there was some cool things in there, but, like, I started watching it. Like, I got halfway through and I had to start getting ready. I had to stop because this guy, like, it's not, like, a actual, like, production documentary. Mm-hmm. But this guy, the way he's talking is just, like, and then he was talking about
there's one moment I want to get to. I think I know which guy you're talking about.
It's the guy that he pretty much had, he's like, do you hear my kid in the background? Hold on one second.
Oh. He had to get up and leave. Not that guy, but there's another guy in that one that is, his voice is nails on a chalkboard to me. But there's one thing that I want to point out in that documentary, which we'll get there when we get to it. But that documentary is a pile of garbage. And it's unfortunate because, like I said, Kubrick's not here to really explain himself. And he doesn't need to, But I think some of the thing people latch onto with this movie is for all the wrong reasons. Like, this movie is not Kubrick confessing to faking the moon landing. It's just not. maybe it is a tale of Native American genocide. I can definitely get behind that. I can also get behind the Holocaust theory, because Kubrick was, you know, he was known for wanting to create this Holocaust movie, but never getting around to it. So I can definitely see that being applied. But for the most part, a lot of conspiracy theories around this movie are just utter bullshit. And it sucks because you have to weed out the garbage to get to anything that's even remotely, like, worth talking about. But we're already like 20 minutes in. We got a lot to cover on the show. So I want to back up for a little bit. If this is your first time tuning into the Silver Linings Playlist, first of all, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. What we like to do on the show here is we watch movies that don't end in a happily ever after, that don't end with a nice little bow and ribbon on the end of things. Endings that, you know, are either depressing or leave you scratching your head. Endings that when you walk away, you're just not feeling all that great. They just bring you down a little bit. And we try to bring you back up by pointing out something good that happened at the end, hence the silver lining that we find there. This movie, you know, the ending is great. I'll go ahead and say the ending's great. Different from the book, different from the Shining miniseries, which we'll talk about. But in order to do this movie proper, that we have to talk not just about the movie itself, but you have to talk about everything, because there's so much here to get into.
Yeah.
Isn't just what's on screen. There's so much to get into. So with that, why don't we talk about some of the details surrounding the production and the release of The Shining?
Okay, I got a couple things on that. Just a couple fun facts, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, okay. You did your homework.
Should I even talk about parts? Okay, so Snow. All right, so at the end, during the end scene, and of course, we'll get to that. I'm trying to do these facts without any spoiler, anything like that. But during the snow scene at the end of the Hedge Maze, Mother Nature decided not to give him enough snow. Right? So.
Yeah. And I just found this out actually while researching it for this episode.
Yeah. They decided to put filler with, 900 tons of salt and shredded styrofoam.
Yeah, a lot of that snow is not snow in this movie. It's mostly salt and styrofoam, which is crazy because it looks so good on screen.
Yeah, it really did. Especially like falling snow. When the falling snow was coming down, the fact that that's salt and styrofoam, absolutely great. All right. So everybody has seen the elevator shot. Okay, that's not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yep.
So Kubrick lied to the MPAA that he was not using real blood. In fact, he did, but then when they reviewed it, they're like, I thought you didn't use real blood, and he said it wasn't. It was rusty water.
It's rusty water, yeah.
Yes.
Like, by the way, I just want to point out, this is like watching your kid blossom from like a little toddler to a full-grown adult. I love watching you read these things that I know, and I'm glad the audience is learning this too, that maybe they don't know, but I'm just so proud. Oh, to see someone do this much research for my favorite movie.
And it's, look, because like I said, I knew this was going to be a special episode. I have been on a total of one podcast, and I wanted to bring everything, man. No holds bars. We're doing it. Did you know there was an alternate ending, Dustin?
I did know about the alternate ending. Talk about that. We can talk about that when we get to the movie. I just want to talk about, like, if people aren't too familiar with this movie, which, you know, how could you not be at this point? But if you are someone who's never seen The Shining, all you have to know is the year is 1980. The director, as we mentioned, was Stanley Kubrick. The film stars Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Scatman Crothers, and Danny Lloyd. The budget was $19 million, and it managed to gross $46.5 million, so a hit.
Highest grossing, one of the highest grossings of that year. Of that decade, actually.
And right at the beginning, too, came out in 1980. Like, in – it's technically like a 70s movie because it was filmed – it took a year to film this movie, which is unheard of. Like, it's so long for a movie to film.
And see, that's the facts that you know that I don't, that
– Principal photography took a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Currently, it sits at 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is, it has to be in the 90s. This movie deserves to be in the 90s.
But also, when the movie first came out, it...
critically panned, for the most part.
Critically panned. So, those critics probably just bred, and that's why it's only 84.
Yeah. It currently sits at number 62 on IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. And this is so upsetting. I didn't know about this until I was researching for this episode. This movie was nominated for 2 Razzies.
Worst actress.
In the first year of the Razzies. Shelley Duvall for Worst Actor and Kubrick for Worst Director, which I can't put my head in the headspace of seeing this movie for the first time in 1980 and not thinking that it's, you know, brilliantly directed and brilliantly acted. Like, Shelley Duvall is out fucking standing in this movie. Like, she gets better every time I see her in this movie. I know there's a lot of criticism with that she's just playing the quote unquote dumb woman that's just there for like,
yeah, okay, like, but
slaughter.
Does that make her a bad actor that she plays a good dumb woman? No,
she's doing so much. Like, Nicholson is doing great work, but I feel like he's got the easy part. She is the heart of this movie. Her and Danny are the heart of this movie. And, you know, Danny's a child actor. He can only do so much. But even with that, Danny Lloyd is also amazing in this movie. Shelley Duvall is fucking bringing it.
It's a pretty popular fact that she was completely abused during the filming of this by Stanley Kubrick.
Yes.
Okay, so people say abuse. Other people say she was pushed, you know, getting the best she could.
So I'm glad we're talking about this now. We can get this kind of out of the way. Yes, I will say this was not an easy production by any means. Like, this was hard, hard work. But there is some fabrication surrounding that. Like, the idea that Kubrick shot that scene of him and her going up the stairs and everything when during like where Jack's got the base, well, she's got the baseball bat, yeah, did not take 127 takes or whatever they say it was. No, the first AD and the camera operator have denied that. It does take a lot. I mean, I'm not saying that he didn't do probably like 30 takes of that, but it's also a really hard scene to shoot. Like, they go around that entire room. Like, it's going to take a lot of takes. It's a
very long shot showing a lot of emotion.
A lot of movement, a lot of lines to be delivered.
It's a lot. And, gosh, what was I about to say? Watched a few things about the whole how many times it took. Kubrick, it doesn't matter what shots he's doing, what scene he's in. Even if the actors get it right like the fifth time, he's going to do 60 takes just to see what happens. Scatman Crothers, you know, he's a musician. He's on and then the ice cream scene, Scatman just finally just like, I can't do this shit anymore. Like, you gotta take or not. Like, what's up? He was getting frustrated. Meanwhile, Danny just gives you a shit ton of ice cream. So they're like, well, he's not being abused. He's good. Scatman had a huge problem.
Well, here's the thing too. Like, Kubrick unfairly, I think, gets this, you know, reputation of being a perfectionist to the point of being a nihilist almost, or like being abusive to his cast and crew. But he's not, first of all, he's not the first and only director to do this. I mean, Michael Bay does this, David Fincher does this, Hitchcock did this. But the difference is, sometimes you have to do those things. You have to push your, I'm not saying you have to abuse him. You don't have to, you know, take a movie and turn it into a torture fest, but like, look at the performance we get out of Janet Leigh in Psycho. Look at the performance we get out of, I can't remember her name now, but the woman from The Birds. Look at the performance we get out of Shelley Duvall in this movie. Like, it breeds amazing results, things that stand the test of time. And, you know, Hitchcock was famous for saying, I don't think my actors are cattle, but I treat them like cattle. And what I always interpret that to mean is, actors are a tool. Yes, they're human beings, and no movie is above, like, you know, death or abuse, physical, emotional, verbal, whatever it is. However, the director's job is to get the best performance and to get the tone that he needs for that scene, for that movie to work. And while he does cross a line with Shelley Duvall, like, you can see it in the documentary that his daughter Vivian Kubrick shot, he does cross a line. There's also something I did not know about, and I don't know how much credit there is to this rumor, but, you know, from what I can see in the documentary and what I can read about from the crew behind the scenes, one of the, you know, I don't want to say excuses, but one of the reasons a lot of people point to Kubrick having such animosity towards Shelley Duvall was that she was abusing drugs on set, like doing a lot of cocaine. There's even one specific moment in the Vivian Kubrick documentary, which we'll get to at the end, but it's when Shelley Duvall is showing that her hair is falling out and like showing it to, I think who, maybe the art director or something, just showing like strands of hair coming out from her stress. And Kubrick offhandedly makes a comment of says to somebody like, don't pity her or something like that. And you can see Shelley Duvall kind of wipe her nose, like, you know, as you would after doing a line of coke.
Right.
Which, again, I can't give this theory credit because I don't know the facts. I wasn't there. I can only say what I've seen. But I didn't know about this until recently, and I've, you know, read up on it, and some cast and crew say it was true. Time. But
I feel like late 70s
when they're filming this. So
everybody's doing cocaine.
Again,
that wasn't only just 900 tons of salt and shredded.
Yeah, it's not just styrofoam. Not just salt and styrofoam out there. But again, it's unfortunate too that Shelley Duvall has also deteriorated like so rapidly recently. I couldn't find the full interview, but I saw clips of her or Dr. Phil interview, and it's disgusting what he did, like to put her on a stage like that and show the whole world. But to say that this is like the result of Kubrick, you know, abusing her in the 80s, I don't buy that at all. Like, she's an older woman. Like, it's unfortunate that things happen like that, but she still had an acting career after that. You know, she was in Popeye and a bunch of other stuff, and I don't think her experience on this movie led. I mean, then again, I don't know. I wasn't there. Who's to say?
Yeah, we're not defending or we're attacking anybody.
This just is looking at it from all different angles. Yeah, it's all. I just want to get the full story out there. I would love to know, you know, from firsthand experiences more. But this is what I'm going off of, and like I said, not defending it. But again, the performance Shelley Duvall gives in this movie is amazing. It's bar none one of the best performances I've ever seen.
We're all familiar with Jack Nicholson's career. I feel like we don't need to touch too much on that. But Danny, what's his name again?
Danny Lloyd.
That's the actor's name?
Yes. And also, you know, playing Danny in the movie.
Oh, cool. Convenient. He had a very small TV role after The Shining. And then after that, I read up somewhere where he
pops up in Dr. Sleep as a cameo, but yeah, he doesn't do much acting after this.
Yeah, and basically he is a school teacher and a pig farmer now. But the fun fact about it is he was 5 when the movie was filmed. He didn't even see the movie until he was 16. Okay. And he didn't even know he was in a horror movie that whole time.
Yeah, I think he said he was in a romantic comedy or something like that they thought he was in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kubrick had a real good way with working with kids, man.
Yeah, so that goes back to the whole menace or, you know, good guy. Like, okay, he's abusing her, but treating this kid. Again, we can't go there.
He's great with Danny behind the scenes. Like, when he's directing Danny, it's amazing because, you know, Danny Lloyd's giving an interview to Vivian, like, in that documentary, and he is just as happy as can be, and it's amazing how quickly he switches from being like the happy little 5-year-old, like laughing and giggling and doing that thing that kids do where they just have run-on sentences that make no sense. But then when he gets on set and he's in front of the camera, like, he's doing so fucking much as a kid, like, and to not know he's in a horror movie is wild.
That to be hidden from, okay, so, and I thought about that and I read that fact after I watched the movie and I was like, there's scenes where you're doing this weird thing with your voice and just screaming red rum. There's scenes where you're looking at the camera completely terrified, like that terrified look, and you thought you're in a comedy?
Yeah.
My man, like
he's active on Twitter too, and I've you know, messaged him back and forth a few times. He's so polite and so grateful, and
that's awesome.
Really love Dr. Sleep. And you know, there's a lot of his Kubrick's family on Twitter and stuff as well that are active. Yes, so it's
okay, that segue into Kubrick's family. Brother-in-law was executive producer on The Shining. The movie that was made right before The Shining, that he did.
Barry Lyndon, I think, is
this. It was a really boring movie. It did awful. And it basically, the way I was reading the article thing, it was, seemed like a genius director was bored, so he made a boring movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when
Hitchcock did the same with Psycho. Like, he had done his big movie and went back to, like, the small roots. Like, let me make a horror movie or something low budget, you know.
And then The Shining, like, and again, right away, critics didn't take too well of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what The Shining is all about. Like, it, first view, you, like, it's going to make you watch it. Like, he wants you to watch it multiple times. It's like, mm-hmm. you walk out like, I don't get that movie. I don't like it. Why don't I like it? I don't know. Let me go watch it again. And then by mm-hmm. the time you realize, like, wow, I like the movie. But continue going. His daughter and wife, I think,
mm-hmm.
was the set designers.
And well, Vivian, I know, was, I don't know if she had a part of the crew of this movie, but she did, you know, she was on set filming the behind the scenes. In terms of his wife, I wasn't familiar with that she had any involvement with the movie. But
I daughter and somebody
mm-hmm.
Was set design and wardrobe or something like that. Basically, he had his family involved with it, which I thought was really cool.
Speaking of Vivian, her documentary is great. She is a full right-wing nut job on Twitter, and it's so sad. But then also, Kubrick's, I believe his stepdaughter, Catherine Kubrick, is also on Twitter and is the exact opposite. And it's interesting to see them two. Yeah, like, I don't even think they speak, but, like, I followed both of them. And
I bet they don't even follow each other.
Probably not. All right, well, we've already done a lot of talking about this movie. And, you know, I was going to play a trailer from the movie for the 4K restoration, but since it's not the original trailer, which was just the opening of the elevator. Like, that was the teaser trailer for the movie. It's just the opening of the elevator with, like, a text scroll. Yeah, it's not worth playing. So, here's what I want to do. This is going to – we're already 30 minutes into this episode, and we haven't even really started talking about the movie. I want to split this into a couple parts. I want to talk about the movie itself, like, just the plot. I want to talk about the movie's legacy. And then a little bit about Kubrick himself, which we've kind of already done. And then that's going to wrap up our discussion on The Shining. And then after that, I want to get into all the associated stuff. I want to get into Room 237. I want to get into that documentary a little bit more, Dr. Sleep, the miniseries, all now, that.
Keep in mind, okay, so the miniseries, look, I watched it when I was a kid. We don't need to watch that again. Dr. Sleep.
I had never seen it until just a few days ago.
God. Even as a kid, I was like, this kid's haircut's fucking stupid.
Oh, that bowl cut.
Woof. Yo, Jesus. Woof. Anyways, but I have not seen Dr. Sleep yet. Okay. Unfortunately. So,
I won't give you any spoilers, but we'll talk in generalities about it.
Yes, because that's, I have questions. I'm like, how does The Shining work? That was my kind of like.
We'll give a little tease. Dr. Sleep is amazing. I'll go ahead and tell you.
You did, like, I
love the movie. I haven't read the book, but I've heard the book is dog shit. So, take that what you will.
Right. Okay. How do you want to crack this open?
Well, let's talk a little bit about Kubrick first. What do you think about this idea? I mean, we kind of briefly just talked about this with Hitchcock, but there's this idea of once a director kind of achieves greatness, like Kubrick kind of had it early on with 2001.
Right.
And then, he's got Lolita, he's got Barry Lyndon, he's got Spartacus. Like, he's a household name. And he's, like you said, Barry Lyndon comes out and it seems like somebody who's bored. Hitchcock did the same. You know, he had Vertigo, North by Northwest, and then does Psycho.
Yeah.
And both, we just saw this recently with Tarantino. Like, Tarantino did this big movie, Hateful Eight, very ambitious, but also, like, a kind of tired trope, like we're used to seeing. And then he goes and does this much quieter movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like, I don't know what this is about directors that once they've hit the crowning achievement in their eyes, that they go back to their roots and they do these little movies, which I love because they're all, like, my favorites. You know, like, Psycho's one of my favorite Hitchcock movies and The Shining's one of my favorite Kubrick movies.
Unpopular opinion, but I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
It's – every time I watch it, it gets better.
I think it's because they – once they get that hype, you know what I mean? They get that –
Yeah.
Oh, it's a Quentin Tarantino movie. You'll love it. You know, like, it has that niche. I guess once you get that, you go in expecting a Quentin Tarantino movie or something like that. And if you, if the director doesn't deliver on that, then of course people are going to get upset or something. You know what I mean? But as far as why they hit their big thing and then going back down, maybe it's just, I couldn't tell you. But it seems like that's a thing that happens.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, a past guest on the show, Dylan Merriman, told me once about this idea that every third movie a director puts out is kind of the quieter one. Like with Tarantino, he did Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs. Well, let me rephrase that. Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and then he does Jackie Brown. And Jackie Brown seems like a movie he should be doing nowadays in his older age, and he's more refined and everything.
Okay,
And then he did the same thing with Django Unchained, Hateful Eight, and then Once Upon a Time. Like they seem to do this in patterns, and it's interesting. I don't know why either. I love the idea though that like, okay, I can do anything I want, but let me go back and do this little thing. Maybe
it's because so let's go off Dylan's theory.
Mm-hmm.
You make one great movie. Ah, dude, that was great. Let's keep the ball rolling. We're going to give you this one. Okay, and then it's absolutely phenomenal. Dude, you killed it. Look, we're going to give you free reigns. Do whatever you want to. Okay. Mm-hmm. I feel like Fincher did this too. Huh?
Yeah. I feel like Fincher did this. I want to say I might be missing one, but isn't it like Panic Room, The Game, and then Curious Case of Benjamin Button? No, there's got to be something else in there. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting idea. Like, The Shining is like a much lower budget, much smaller thing. And it's interesting too, because I read an interview where Stephen King, who, you know, has had a contemptuous relationship with this movie, that he's since come around on it. But of course, when it came out, he hated it. He despised Kubrick for what he did. And he was doing this interview, I can't remember with who, but he said that the way this movie came about for Kubrick was Kubrick told his staff to like bring him just stacks and stacks of horror books, and he was going to read them in his office. And Kubrick's secretary would like hear this thud sound every few like minutes or hours. And apparently it was Kubrick just reading the first like couple pages of a book and just tossing it to the wall, into the trash.
Jesus.
And after a while, she didn't hear the thuds anymore, and she went back in and saw that he was reading The Shining. And that's how he decided to make that movie.
So that's like, sick.
Yeah, it's interesting too that he's like, I done Barry Lyndon, I want to do horror because I haven't really done horror. Bring me all the books, and then just thud, 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 thud. Oh, I found gold, you know. And I, as someone who hasn't read the book, I do know there are a lot of differences from the book that the miniseries tries to make up for, but ultimately it's just, you know, maybe it's just that miniseries, but it just doesn't work as well.
Yeah, like the whole the hedge animals and stuff like that.
Yeah, look horrible. The CG looks horrible.
Yeah, that was even on the cover of the original Shining book.
I think it works if you have the hedge maze that's in this movie, and then you put the hedge maze animals in it. But just to have them out walking around in the snow, it looks ridiculous. It looks so bad in that miniseries.
Yeah. I don't know. You say not to judge a book by its cover, but that's exactly what a cover's for. That is a Michael Che joke. I don't want to copyright that. But
yeah,
if he looked at that book cover, and if he was looking at all the book covers and judging them before he was throwing them,
mm-hmm.
and he saw that one and that's the one he opened up, then
yeah,
yeah, we question the madness. That shit looks rough.
All right. Well, I mean, that's all I really want to talk about Kubrick. Like, I could talk for hours about Kubrick, but let's just get into The Shining. I mean, we're 45 minutes almost in now. Let's finally talk about The Shining.
Yeah.
This movie it's hitting every cylinder. Like, it looks amazing. It's directed amazing. It's the performances. Everyone is bringing it. And I find very few flaws with it. Like,
yes. What I like about it is, okay, so it's a horror movie, it's a thriller, in some scenes it's a slasher, in a couple it's supernatural.
Yep.
I guess.
Yep.
And I was going somewhere with this, but basically what I was getting at is that on top of everything, it's just a giant mystery. Like, at the end of the day, like, what is going on? What I like about this, basically, horror movies nowadays, like, or even back then, okay? Like, the opening intro or the opening scene.
Yeah, we get right into it.
Like, well, no, hold on. The opening scene, you got to get scared. They got to throw something in there to get you scared, to get you in, you know, to show you what's interesting. It can even reveal the villain. And I'm using Halloween as an example. It shows them where he kills his sister immediately. And we're back at Smith's Grove, you know, and he escapes. Wow, that's been 15 minutes. This, it explains nothing to you at all. And it just kind of leaves you like, okay, is he going crazy? Is the hotel haunted? Like, you don't understand anything. And it doesn't just spoon feed it to you.
Well, here's what I like about the beginning. Like, I say we get right into it because the opening shot of just that small island on the lake, and we're just zooming past it, and the score is kicking in. And the score is one that I've had a weird relationship with it. Like, I come and go on how much I love it and how much it's, like, it's weird because I always took it as like a French horn or a tuba for like the theme. But I've also read that it's a synthesizer. So, like, I don't know. Like, it's an organ. And I don't know. But I always
was like, this sounds like Godzilla theme.
A little bit. But then the part that I like the most about it is when that horn kind of trails off and then you get, it's just the shot of him driving up into, like, the further up we go, that we're like, we're in the stratosphere, like the clouds and the snow and everything. And then we get those moans of like a woman screaming, kind of, you know, it's almost like you would imagine, like, in The Witch, like just the kind of cackling and stuff. But it's like, it's almost as if it's like the souls of the Overlook crying out as Jack's driving further and further up. And I love it so much.
Okay. I like that. The music is absolutely everywhere. And again, well, I'm trying to stay on topic and let's get through this. We talked about, what's the term called it in, our last podcast we were in together, just random cuts where it's just like a stinger. That's what you call it.
A stinger. Yeah.
And where they use it in random moments in that movie, in this one where the music, it's instead of it being stingers, it's the music tenses up. And you're like, oh my God, why am I on edge? Like, he's just throwing a tennis ball at the wall. Why did something happen and I didn't see it?
They do a lot with the sound in this movie. The one part that sticks out to me that I absolutely love the most is Danny on his tricycle. Like, when he's the first time you see him,
the hardwood.
Yes, we're following him, like, with the Steadicam. And this was also one of the first few movies to use Steadicam. So, like, we're pioneering technology with this movie. And
it was handled by the person who invented it.
Yes.
He was the one filming it.
The inventor of the Steadicam was on set for this one. Yep. But yeah, when they're following Danny and he's, you know, hits the rug, hardwood floor, rug, hardwood, and it like cuts out almost completely. It's such a good like sound design. There's no music there because you don't need the music. It's tense just hearing that start, stop.
It's a rhythm. Like, it's a rhythm and music is rhythm. It's the drum
section. I would love to see a trailer that uses that as the sound bed for this movie. Like, just that hardwood floor sound and then the moments of silence in between. It's so fucking good. And then, of course,
I love it when a movie trailer, like, and I'm using a trailer, for example, when they take, like, and again, I'm going to go back to Godzilla. Godzilla used, I can't remember. I think it was like Bohemian Rhapsody or something like that. But, or maybe it's just a Queen song. Either way, it doesn't matter. During the monster fight, as the beat goes, it, you know, like they're punching each other or biting each other. It just makes it, I love it when it's on sync like that.
Oh yeah. Like, I like when they use sound design from the movie. They just pick one little moment or one little sound to really drive that, like, well, you know, we're talking about trailers now, but like, the one I think of is like Alien, when it uses the siren as like the sound bed for the trailer. Or when we talked about Uncut Gems recently, there's that one like almost like a break sound effect from that Kanye West song. And then like, that's the driving force of like the Uncut Gems trailer. But this movie, I feel like they're doing that tenfold with the sound design. Like there, and then there's odd choices too for the score. Like there's that weird Chinese gong when Danny first sees the Shining sisters in the hallway. It's a weird choice. Like, why a gong? But my favorite instance of the score in this movie, by far, more so than the theme song, and I don't even know how to describe it. It's used a lot in the climax, but it's like, you know, when Wendy first sees dead Scatman Crothers on the floor.
Okay, I have notes on that because every there's like a so when Wendy finds a Scatman and Wendy's trying to find Danny, Danny is currently being chased around. It changes themes when it goes to the Danny and Jack chase. It changes the score. I mean, there's remnants and it lingers, but then when it cuts to Wendy, who is having a horrible time, by the way.
Just something freaking changed. Out, seeing the weirdest
something
shit.
Changed. I've been hearing these scores throughout the entire movie, and then something came new right here in the last 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was like this weird chanting thing. Every time, and because I backed it up, every single time you heard that chanting, she was about to see a dead person, or she was about to experience something really awful. About to
see a ghost or something, yeah.
Yeah, like, it was going
to
be awful.
Yep. This was, like, the first movie to really show me cinematography in a way that I hadn't seen before, and, like, really helped me to understand, you know, composition and language and everything. It's so amazing, like, to see, like, when Jack's swinging the axe into the door.
I have that in my notes, too.
And the camera follows through with everything. It's so intense. Jesus. It's such a simple trick. And, you know, nowadays, a lot of movies won't do that because they don't want the camera to be, like, locked down and moving just left to right. They want to have that free movement. But, you know, and you can see Kubrick is the one, you know, camera operating in those shots. Like, you can see him, like, the behind-the-scenes shots of him, like, holding the camera handle, and like, you know, he doesn't know when Jack Nicholson's gonna swing back for the next swing either. And you can see him with anticipation. Yeah, and he's like whips the camera back, whips it forward. It's so fucking, it brings this sort of chaotic energy that, like, you know, you don't see a lot in movies. And
I feel like I've seen something like that recently, and this is throwaway dialogue.
They do a little bit of Dr. Sleep. They do a little bit of an understatement.
But I'm talking about like the, like it's someone swinging. God, I can't remember something I watched not too long ago. But the camera did the follow work with the instrument of whatever the person's swinging versus, composition wise, it just makes it look so good.
Plus, you know, I mean, Kubrick's his affinity for like force perspective and everything. Everything is in focus. Everything is driven to the center of that focal plane on the lens.
I was going to mention that too. Like, okay, so if you notice in this movie, almost everything is centered. A lot of shots, whatever you're supposed to be looking at, is in the very center frame, and the set design around that center person is perfectly frames what you're supposed to be looking at. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like going down hallways, for example. Who walks directly in the middle of a hallway? Think about it. Like, even if no one's down that hallway, in this movie, everybody's walking right in the middle, so it's all centered and stuff. But going back, fun fact, Jack Nicholson went through over 60 doors doing that scene.
Because he was a trained
volunteer fireman.
Yeah, they had to get in real doors because the prop doors, he kept breaking too quickly.
I'm going
to
get one on you that you didn't know. That's my goal.
I'm sorry, buddy. Most things I'm going to know. I'm sorry to tell you. Speaking of more of the cinematography, though, like, there's certain things that Kubrick chooses to do in this movie that I feel like a lot of directors and directors of photography wouldn't do. Like, the one thing I'm thinking about in particular is when Danny goes into room 237 and, you know, Jack has his nightmare and Wendy comes to save him. He's like, oh, I had this most horrible dream.
Right.
And, you know, she's consoling Jack in his chair. And then Danny comes in sucking on his thumb. When you know, we're behind Danny, but we're above him, kind of looking down so we can see everybody in the room. I feel like any other DP would be low on the ground and just feel Danny's back as like the center point of that shot. You know, like we're following right behind him.
Yeah, but then we're the extremely long. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say we're above him, so we can not only see Danny, but we can see Jack and Wendy way in the background.
Right.
And to me, that's like, oh, that's the lady from room 237 walking right behind him. Like, that's the ghost of the Overlook walking behind Danny, like a foreboding presence. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I feel like most DPs wouldn't do stuff like that in a horror movie. Like, they want to make, you know, everything those tight shots, you get the most reaction. And there's a lot of wide shots in this movie.
They chop it up like that's also a really, really long shot. Okay, so mm-hmm. like Jack's being consoled on the ground, and they are blurry. That's mm-hmm. how far away they are. And because I was, you know, Wendy was like, Jack, just go up to your room. Or sorry, Danny, just go up to your room. I'll be there in a second, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just standing there and she's consoling. She's like, why didn't you mind me? And is walking to him.
Yeah.
And it's almost realistic because it's not until she gets right up on him when like, oh shit, something's wrong type thing.
Yeah.
Where I feel like if anybody else, it would be cut between shots at Wendy telling Danny to go upstairs. I feel like today it would have been the camera behind Wendy and Jack and
yep.
a far shot of
yeah.
Danny walking in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it, yeah. Just it, different ideas of, like that is what kind of goes crazy with me.
Yeah. Especially with like the long shots of this movie. What I think of is, I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but the editor for Mad Max Fury Road. I think we talked about this on the podcast before, but she won, you know, the Oscar for best editing that year. And her, you know, advice was never cut unless you're getting new information. Like there's no reason to do back and forth unless you're getting new info that you can't get from the previous shot. And I feel like they do that a lot in this movie. Like that shot in particular, we follow Danny all the way from the outside of that foyer, like all the way up to when he first meets up with Wendy and she sees the bruising on his neck. And right then is when we flip and we break that 180 rule, which if you're not familiar, you know, the camera is on 180 degree axis with whoever's right. in front of them. And when you flip that, you're letting the audience know things have changed. Subconsciously, things have changed. And that's when she stands up and she says, you did this, and points to Jack, you know?
Right.
Like, that's when she's getting new information.
I also have that as notes. I was like,
oh, the face Wendy. He gives her is hilarious. He's like,
that's my favorite. That's low.
It's such a good reaction.
That's my favorite because literally he, like, bitch, you woke me up from a night terror. Like, yeah. I have been.
His reaction
are
is
you
gold.
Serious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, and again, this was the movie where I learned about, like, the breaking of the 180 and what that means. And, like, the big example you can point to also is when Jack and Grady are in the bathroom. And, you know, and he's like, Grady, you chopped your family up into little pieces. And he's like, oh, I don't have any recollection of that at all.
Yeah, the camera stayed on Jack mm-hmm. until the narrative like, swap.
You're the caretaker. And then it flips.
Yep.
We go to the other side of that bathroom, which that bathroom set is one of the best sets I've ever seen.
Yes. Okay. Ugh. I'm so glad because I was going to bring this up when we were talking about 237.
Mm-hmm.
The entire, let's say the basic color palette of what you see
mm-hmm.
so far up until this point has been reds, browns, oranges,
A lot of earthy tones, like
yeah,
muted.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Even in the room that they're staying in, their little suite or whatever. It's mm-hmm. pretty generic. It's like white, something else. Anyways, the three other locations, not talking about rooms, sorry, three other rooms. We got mm-hmm. the gold ballroom. Which of course is completely different. Gold.
Okay, to me,
it's
cool. is hideous. I think yes, that room is so ugly.
It's
other
really
than the bar.
Bad.
The bar looks amazing.
The bar is sick. Especially
the bar
lights
is so
like,
good.
Going around the mirrors. Yeah. Anyways.
Yes.
Okay. Then we got room 237, which takes a huge shift to purples, blues, greens.
That bathroom's great looking too. But
gold.
That
okay.
that carpet
first,
is hideous. The
yeah,
dip
so
carpet.
Dude, that's
gross.
Like a bowling alley carpet.
It like, is a bowling alley carpet.
So at first glance, I was like, yo, this bathroom is fucking ugly. But then I paused it because I was writing notes and I was like, yeah, actually, this bathroom's kind of fire.
It's
like,
the green color is kind of sickly and it's very of the
look,
time.
No, it's
but
fine.
It's also
because the toilet's green. If
the
toilet
the toilet's
wasn't green,
that's
green
what, yeah.
I agree. I would have loved it. If why does the toilet got to be green? Okay, and then shifting again to the bathroom, which is a dope ass bathroom.
We're talking about the gold room bathroom, the red room.
Yes.
Yes, it's amazing.
Looks so good. The red, just red and white. Just
well, it's like the first real pop of color in the movie. Like everything else, like you said, has been like muted, earthy tones, and we get like even the gold room doesn't look that colorful.
No, like, the carpet was pretty crazy, but that was it. Yeah, nothing insane.
Yeah. No, I agree. The like I said, the cinematography, the color, everything in this movie is working top shelf. It's all running on full cylinders. It's amazing. I just want to talk about a few little things. I mean, we can talk about how much we love certain things, but just little things I took note of on this rewatch that I thought were funny. Omen, you know, the guy that gives Jack the job.
The manager?
Yes. Looks like a discount JFK.
Nope, I have in my notes right now, he looks like the host of Wheel of Fortune. I don't know his name.
Yes, he looks like Pat Sajak, yeah.
it's written right here, I swear to God.
I don't know why, but he's a good looking guy, but it's the hair, like the hair is like almost it might be a wig. I don't know, it might be a wig, but for some reason I got JFK on this rewatch, and I could definitely see Pat Sajak.
That was the first thing I went to.
So that's glad we both got that. We have this reoccurring bit on the show that anybody that drinks milk in a movie, just a glass of milk, is usually a psychopath. And I noticed on this rewatch, Danny drinks a glass of milk when we first see him eating that peanut butter and jelly sandwich at the table.
He makes it up with a glass of chocolate milk. Well, Tony drinks a glass of chocolate milk at the end. So I don't know, maybe... Do we count them as the same?
Maybe. I mean, well, you get more clarification on who and what exactly Tony is in Dr. Sleep, which... Well,
tell me this, Dustin. In Dr. Sleep, does he drink white or chocolate milk?
He drinks a lot of alcohol. I can't remember him drinking any milk, actually.
Well, okay, what kind of alcohol? Bourbon?
He does do bourbon. I think he's more of a Scotch man in Dr. Sleep, though.
All right, well, I guess I respect it.
Yeah. I love the look of the Overlook Hotel so much in this movie. It's so massive, and like the wide shots we see of it, it's so dreadful looking. It's really upsetting because when you see that miniseries, that hotel looks like dog shit compared to this.
It looked the miniseries looked too pleasant.
It's too small, and the big problem I have with it is that it in the miniseries it's like down in a valley. In this one, it's high up on a mountain, which. Makes sense. You're going way out of the way. You're like, it's not as pleasant. Like, you're surrounded by snow and everything. Yeah, I don't know. But it's interesting, too. What were you going to say?
No, I was saying the Overlook in Kubrick's, it's almost, okay, medieval or anything like that. It just kind of has that gothic looking.
It does have a very gothic-y kind of aura.
So, if they made a log cabin gothic...
Yeah.
This is what it would be. I can see that. And it's just dreadful. It's eerie. It's...
Yes.
And it's
mostly a facade. Like, a lot of the shots outside are not of the actual hotel.
Something like that. Yeah, I saw that documentary on there. It's the one in the miniseries. It just looks too pleasant to be at.
It doesn't look like a hotel. It looks just like a bed and breakfast.
Yeah. I don't know. It looks... It almost looks like an awful plantation home or something.
This might be little things that you might have picked up on your research, but did you notice Jack's tie when he's in the interview at the beginning of the movie?
Is it like I noticed it was like someone knitted a tie.
It's a knit
for
tie,
him.
But it's the hedge maze. It's basically the hedge maze.
Oh, don't get me fucking started. Don't get me started on this.
That's the kind of stuff, like, when people are talking about, like, Kubrick's a perfectionist. But then again, that's probably more so on the wardrobe side of things. But even still, it's a nice little touch. Because it's such an odd tie.
He let it in, so...
Yeah, it's such an odd tie, like, to wear. Like, knitted ties in general. And
I would not wear that shit to an interview.
No, it's too...
Gotta impress him.
It's too wide and it's too out there. It's too niche. I just couldn't pull it off.
It's also knitted.
Yeah, knitted ties. You really got to be able to pull that off. Like,
yeah.
Man.
Okay. Let's go on the hedge maze. Let's go ahead and get this out of the way.
Okay. So this is interesting. So,
all right.
For the listener, when JT was watching this movie, he was letting me know he was taking notes. You had a real affinity for this hedge maze.
Look, okay, so I've known they existed for the longest time, guys, but so many questions. I'm like, first off, why is that an attraction? Like, look, just the, you could have made a maze out of wood, something easier, like, if you wanted to get people lost. So, also, I had the question, who was the guy that first invented it? And also, like, so, what does he do? He plants these bushes into certain patterns, and people are like, what the hell? And it's like, oh, well, in 20 years, you're going to be freaking out.
So, here's what I think. Like, I never thought about this until you brought it up, but it is weird that, like, you know, I think what happened is when they, because they say they built the hotel in, like, a, what, 2-year time span or something, like 3 years? I'm thinking they just hauled bushes up there, but that's, you know, they just hauled bushes from another, yeah, a second location. Of
course. Yeah, as far as the growth,
like, fully grown bushes is what I'm saying. But I don't think they brought
it was actually designed, like, from scratch, a maze. They didn't follow a template or anything to get, you know, they didn't Google generic hedge maze and then just did that. Fun fact, during shooting and stuff like that, they had to shout and because they got lost and people came in with a map or whatever to get them. Stanley Kubrick himself had, they said, or he said, if I can't get lost in it, it's no good. We got to redo it.
Yeah.
And so he straight in, went in, and after about an hour, he started yelling. He got lost.
See, that I did not know, but that's pretty... Well, here's the thing about the hedge maze.
Yes, fuck yeah.
I get it as a tourist attraction, because like the hotel itself is a tourist attraction. I get that as like, you know, it's the 70s when we're filming this movie. The hedge maze has probably been around a lot longer than that.
Right.
My thing is it's just too big. Like... It's fine to have a hedge maze, but this thing, when we get that top down view of the hedge maze, which I still to this day don't know how they filmed that shot.
I do. Dustin, I got
Oh, you know how they filmed it.
I know how they filmed it. I know how they filmed it. Okay.
Okay. So, is it miniatures?
No. Okay. So they filmed the top down view of the model of the hedge maze, right?
Okay.
Then they made just that center, if you pull up an image, just the center of the hedge maze where it shows
Wendy
little bitty tiny Wendy and Danny walking in. That was actually filmed in a – it's essentially these four giant apartment complexes that make a square.
Okay.
And the film crew
they just overlaid the image.
Yeah, the film crew was on the roof of this apartment complex really high up in the air and shot them just – playing.
Okay, that makes sense.
And then they overlaid it on the actual model, so when it overlays into them actually in the actual hedge maze going from top down, the outside of that shot is still the model that Jack's looking at.
Right, that makes sense. I was, you know, every time I see this movie, I'm like, they filmed this shit in the 70s. There's no way they could have got a bird's eye view this high up, like this perfect. It's and I love, too, that the shot right before that is Jack looking over the little model of the hedge maze in the hotel, and it's like he's looking down on them. It's so fucking brilliant, and that shot is beautiful.
Yes, like, it's absolutely. It's so
got a lot
strange.
Of great cinematography, and the wide shots are some of the best. It's amazing.
I'm trying to think of some wide shots other than that one that pops out. Okay, going back to hedge mages. So, like, who keeps up with them? You know, like after so long, like I know, like. After about 2 weeks, like, you know, the ones I have outside, like, they need to be trimmed up and shaped up. You telling me you have a full staff of just hedge people, or like...
I think so, man.
And I guess after you've worked there for so long, you kind of know. Look, I don't know. It just seems like way too much maintenance for no reason.
Hedges. They could very well just be, like, you know, fake bushes that they don't have to trim up. I mean, that would make sense, so you don't have to worry about the weather, like it getting too cold or like getting snowed in or something, you know?
I mean, sure, if you want to take that way out, Dustin.
I'm just trying to think of, like, in-universe what makes the most sense.
Just not having it, I think, would be...
I think you just don't like mazes is the problem.
I just don't think... look, man.
I mean, they got to do something. They don't have the internet back then. Why not? Go fuck around in a hedge maze for an hour.
That's probably the, you know what, the person who invented hedge mage has probably had the same problem. He's like, I'm gonna go outside.
Or he wanted an excuse to, like, He needed a place to go to, like, fool around with a girl, and he's like, if I make a maze big enough, no one could possibly find it.
These bushes aren't big enough. I can't have sex with my neighbor.
So you're obsessed with the hedge maze. I'm obsessed with the elevator in this movie, because the shot, I mean, it's one of the most iconic shots in film history, but right. The elevator doors being pushed open just by the sheer weight of this blood that pours out of it is insane to me. Like,
I think what I like about it so much is that there's so much mystery behind it. You know what I mean? Like, okay, so for example, the girls, okay, one of the girls there, and then you see their dead bodies. Oh, they were cut up with an axe. Mm-hmm. Why is there a bunch of blood in the elevator?
Well, there's so much blood because it's just like, you know, Grady was not the first one to murder his wife. And there's like, it's the, well, it's also implied that it's like the blood of like all the people that have died there, or like the graveyard it's built on top of. It's also just scary as hell.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, because Kubrick used real blood, it caused electrical problems for all the glucose in the blood.
Well, it's amazing just in that, like, okay, when you film a shot like this, you know, you've got, you do all the engineering work up front, you test it out, make sure it works, and then you try it out for real. I'm just thinking they could, maybe they did only get this in one take.
I don't either.
The furniture bobbing up and down, just in like the buoyancy of the, it's so much blood. And then to think, oh, we got to redress this and do it again to get a second take. We didn't get it. And then how amazing it is that blood washes over the camera and completely blacks it out. It's fucking amazing. It's so good.
The cleanup. Jesus Christ.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like,
see, I feel like I'd be like, hey, just in case, hit record. Because what if this is absolutely amazing? You gotta
have a couple of those sets already made up that you just fly in. You don't have to clean it up. But I don't know what
the person who would be in charge of cleaning that up. I don't know what their official title would be, but like,
yeah. That shot is used so well in this movie, and it's not really a spoiler, but you do see it again, that same shot in Dr. Sleep, but it's unfortunate because it's to a much less effect. Like, you see it, and then the character that's like seeing it is just like, huh, and keeps walking, but so, it's like,
how do you feel about something? Okay, and I'm saying this because of course Dr. Sleep, being a sequel to The Shining, did it need a blood-filled elevator just to be like, oh, look, we're The Shining?
Well, again, since you haven't seen it, and if our listeners haven't seen it, I don't want to spoil too much.
Let me do something else then. So let's take Halloween 1978 and Halloween 2018.
Okay.
Okay. I absolutely loved the scene where her granddaughter looks out the window, just like in...
And sees, sees Jamie Lee Curtis. Michael,
and it's Jamie Lee Curtis. I laughed in the movie theater. It just struck me funny. That's fun. Okay, and then at the end climax fight, when Michael throws her off the balcony, he looks down, and then the granddaughter walks in the front door, and he turns, looks back down, and she's gone. I like that.
My theater cheered at that, man. It was great.
But the scene that was kind of cringe to me, and I hate saying this because I absolutely love Jamie Lee Curtis.
Can I guess? I think I know what you're going to say.
Yes, go ahead.
Is it when she says, Happy Halloween, Michael?
Yes. Oh my gosh. This man has tormented you for over half of your life, and you're going to take that moment to fucking catchphrase? Like, oh, come on. I loved Jamie. Okay, let's talk about Shining though. But yeah, so doing remake sequels, whatever, that's a certain width of time apart, we tend to try to go for the classics, like, oh, the blood-filled elevator. We're bringing back Red Rum. Unless if it has something to do with the plot, then yes, of course, bring it in. But just to have that for the sake of having
I will say, it is all needed for the plot. Like, it's not just, there is some fan servicey stuff in that movie, but in those instances, Red Rum, all that stuff, it is related to the plot directly.
Okay,
and great. It's a great scene, don't get me wrong, but it's the way they do it, it's kind of disappointing, but
it's wasted on a not the viewer audience, but the cast that was, or
it's hard character. To even say without spoiling it. Yeah, to be honest,
let's just move on from Dr. Sleep.
Yeah. We talked about like how this movie can be like unintentionally hilarious at times, which I don't know what that says about you as a person or like, you know, what the movie is saying, but like the part that I laugh at the most is when Jack and Danny and Wendy are first driving up to the Overlook, and you know, Shelley's like,
boy, we must really be high up. The air feels so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like, shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He hates his family so much in this movie. But the part that makes me laugh so hard is when he has to describe to Danny what the Donner family was.
What was the Donner party?
They were a party of settlers in covered wagon times. They got snowbound one winter in the mountains. They had to resort to cannibalism in order to stay alive.
You mean they ate each other up?
They had to, in order to survive.
Jack, don't worry, Mom. I know all about cannibalism. I saw it on TV.
See? It's okay. You saw it on the television.
The look that Jack Nicholson gives right when he says that, he gets that famous Jack Nicholson smile, yeah, and the raised eyebrow, and he's like, see, it's okay, he saw it on the television. Yeah. It's so fucking funny.
Jack Nicholson, again, we could talk about his thing, but let's finally hit on him for a second.
Sure.
He absolutely, like, I mean, this is his famous role, like this, and I think he's known for this and Wolf, right? The werewolf movie that he did. I'm joking, by the way.
I mean, he looks like a werewolf in this movie at times. I mean, he's had a lot of movies like prior to this too, yeah, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
because I can't even remember what it was called.
Yeah, no, especially when he's in the bathroom, in the Red Room bathroom, he looks like a werewolf in some of the shots.
I'm gonna look it up and send it to you. But either way, this is what he's known for, and just the monologues of him by himself. One of my favorite scenes in this entire movie is when he meets Lloyd, the bartender.
The
long shot.
Yeah.
It's from his right of him walking up to the bar. So you see the gold room in the background. He sits down.
Mm-hmm.
First he looks, because again, he hasn't drank in 5 months. He looks behind the counter, alcohol. He sits down, puts his head, face in his hands, and says, I would give my soul for a glass of beer. And then he does the whole, like, shrug, and it's a single frame. Like, it's just looking at him, again, centered, but it's just a headshot of him centered, and those facial expressions, the conversation. Then that's when Lloyd pops up, and he has a dialogue.
Hi, Lloyd. A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What'll it be?
What's so curious about is he's talking to Lloyd like he's known him for a long time, which hints back to the end shot of the entire movie, but you don't know, because that's also how people just talk to bartenders sometimes.
Well, I love that, like, because of course there's nobody else here, and the first time he's talking to Lloyd, that like he does have this sort of relationship of like, you know, the regular and the bartender, but also he like tiptoes around what he really wants to talk about, you know, like he has that moment where he's like,
here's to 5 miserable months on the wagon and all the irreparable harm that it's caused me.
Yeah, like, he wants to vent to somebody, is what it seems like. And
I love, because he's like, I never heard him or whatever. And he goes on this whole defensive thing. And then he kind of, like, smacks his lips and looks around. He's like,
I did hurt him once, okay?
I did hurt him a little.
Yeah. He gets kind of like, okay, maybe just a little bit. I don't, like.
Lloyd, can you keep a secret? I did hurt him a little bit.
Don't tell anybody, though.
It's so good. It's so good.
Okay, so he talks about hurting him and stuff like that. It seems like he's trying to vent,
mm-hmm.
right, about this whole thing. And oh, there it is. He keeps saying, like, and she won't let me forget it. Like, he's like, it was 3 years ago. And he talks, oh, gosh. And then when he talks about, like, the tiniest bit of force used could have just mm-hmm. changed everything. And then Lloyd's just looking at him like, yeah, okay.
Oh, I love he's like, the pounds per inch per second per second. It's so fucking good.
That's why I was drawing a blank there. But yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. He like snaps his fingers. He's like,
yeah, like Jack Nicholson, like he acts with his entire body. Like his every muscle in his face or his facial expressions, he acts everything.
Well, Nicholson was Kubrick's first choice for the role of Jack, and it's, you know, it's interesting because Stephen King, who maybe he's right in the sense, he said that the reason he doesn't like Nicholson as being cast is the whole point of Jack Torrance is he's supposed to go from this, you know, recovering alcoholic, loving father to full-blown crazy. And when you see Nicholson, you know right away that dude's going to go crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, from the jump, he's going to go crazy. I didn't know about this either, but do you want to hear some of the other choices that Kubrick had in mind if Nicholson weren't able to do it?
Who?
So Robert De Niro, which I can kind of see.
Yeah.
An interesting one, Robin Williams.
Ooh.
Who I also could kind of see doing this. And Harrison Ford, which I feel like maybe Harrison Ford could do this.
I would have pitied him more than
I feel like I would have hated Jack more if it was Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I would honestly no. I would have pitied because I don't know. Jack, like Harrison Ford just kind of has that face that like you feel sorry for. You know, like
see, I'm kind of on the edge. He always looks so hardened to me that I find him hard to relate to. Like he looks, you know, it just weathered and aged and like hardened and angry every time I see Harrison Ford.
I mean, I can see that.
So I don't know,
but we can both agree that like it couldn't be anybody else.
Yeah, well, obviously not. Some of the people that Stephen King wanted was John Voight, which I can maybe see. Christopher Reeve, Superman himself. I don't know how well that worked. Maybe. And someone I'm not too familiar with, Michael Moriarty. I don't really know who that is.
Wait, who was, Stephen King's first choice?
Stephen King wanted someone like – he said his personal picks were John Voight, Christopher Reeve, and Michael Moriarty.
And I'm trying to think
Christopher Reeve, maybe. It would be – I don't know how well he would play up – like this scene we're talking about in particular, like the bar scene. I don't know how well that would have worked.
Trying to think of anybody else, but it's so hard to get – you know, to even think about it. Let's talk about
Scatman Crothers. Like
– my man.
God.
Yo, I love this dude. I absolutely love this dude.
Dick Halloran is so fucking good as a character, like, in this movie. He's so likable. He's so charming. And I love that he is able to, like – you know, when we first see him, he's so upbeat. He's almost overly friendly.
Right.
The one thing – I'll get to my point, but I want to side for a second. Something I never really noticed. You know when he's talking to Wendy first when he goes into the kitchen? He's like,
Mrs. Torrance, your husband introduced you as Winifred. Now, are you a Wendy or a Freddy?
Okay. No. Wait. Stop. Stop right there because I paused the movie to go back, listen to it again. I immediately try to find other streaming services if this was playing because I needed subtitles.
Yes.
And I couldn't find it until later. And I was like, damn it, I'm just going to ride over that. I don't know what he said.
It's so strange. I've never really picked up on it until this rewatch, but who names their daughter Freddy? It's such a strange – like I get, is your real name Winifred? That would make sense, but he said, "Are you a Winnie or Winifred or a Freddy?"
Those are
very
the,
strange.
Those are the. That's the first time I've ever heard of Winifred being a name. I learned that is Wendy short for something. I thought it was just Wendy.
Wendy can be short for Winifred. I have heard that. I've never in my life heard of a woman named Freddy that goes by Wendy.
That just makes no sense.
Very absurd.
It's like Richard and Dick. I don't know how that became a thing.
Yeah, I don't know either. But the point I was going to get to, though, is Scatman's able to be this really lovable, charming character. And then the second he gets alone with Danny, he has this very – like the first thing he says is, do you know how I knew your name was Doc or something like that, and it's very foreboding. Like, it's scary.
Well, it's because how... it's probably something... See, the way I see it is, and I actually have it in my notes here, when he talks about, like, how many other people has he met with The Shining? You know what I mean? Like, it's only been him and his grandmother.
Well, he talks about his grandma, but yeah. Again, I think he sees that it's very strong in Danny.
That and Scatman is old in this movie, and he's talking about his grandmother, so he probably hasn't felt anyone else have The Shining for a very, very long time, so it probably freaked him out. Next. Okay, I wasn't gonna... Okay, basically when he talked about him and his grandmother, I was like, I want to see that movie. You know, okay, so we're talking about it being in the set... Like, this was filmed in 79. It came out in the 80s. Scatman is... he doesn't have an age in the movie, but he's older. Okay, and I was like, I want to see that movie. Maybe have a civil rights plot going behind it. And at first I was like, that might kind of be too much. But then the bathroom scene where they say the N-word three times in quick succession, I was like, okay, well, I stand by it. Like, I would love to see a background story of Doc. Maybe him and his grandmother and stuff like that.
Do you think Grady knew Dick Halloran? Like, was Dick working at the Overlook when Grady killed his... family?
Well, I mean, they talk about how he's been, or it, the way they talk, it seems like Doc's been working there for years and years and years.
Yeah, but I don't think Dick ever, like, makes himself connected with Grady at all. I don't think directly, anyway.
No, like, they, as far as they know, they haven't necessarily, or in the movie, they don't talk about each other, or Grady does, but Scatman has, he doesn't recollect that, but I mean, he, okay, now you got me, now I know why you just asked the question, because now I'm thinking about it.
See, that would be an interesting movie. I mean, HBO is currently working on a series called The Overlook that I don't know what the tagline is for it, but, or the log line, I should say, but it would be interesting to see, like, more of these characters, because I love Dick Halloran. Like, he's a great character, he's great in this movie. There's no one like Scatman Crothers, for real. Like, he was, and man, he has one moment in Vivian Kubrick's documentary. He's only in the documentary for one little interview bit, and he is just crying tears. And she's like, what, you know, what did you like about this movie? He said, the people. He's like, everyone, this was the best experience of my life. And he's like,
wow,
genuinely teared up. Like, such a kind, like, gentle old man. It's I love him in this movie.
He actually did a little look up on him just to see. I was like, have I seen him in anything else? There was one thing that is...
He's in the Twilight Zone movie.
That's what it was.
In the Spielberg segment, I think.
He also... One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he is... played, he voiced a character in The Aristocrats in 1970 called Scat Cat.
Yep.
Which I thought was
Scat Cat.
Fun.
Yep.
And he voiced some Transformers and other things.
Yeah. But his also has one of the funniest lines of this movie to me. When he's showing Wendy and Danny the pantry, he's like, we've got 47 chickens, 36 steaks, whatever. And he said something about prunes. He goes,
you know, Mrs. Turris, you got to keep regular if you want to be happy.
And I'm like, this dude basically just said, you got to shit if you want to be happy.
This dude just advertised.
Get you know, Miss Torch, you got to shit a lot if you really want to be upbeat.
Come on, kid, let's go eat some ice cream.
so good.
Another thing, one thing that didn't make sense, and maybe you can shed some light on it, the ice cream scene. He's explaining The Shining stuff, and Danny's like, what's in room 237? Uh-huh. And then he explains, like, you know, well, bad things happen. It leaves a remnant. He's like, it sounds like he says, it's like when someone burns toast.
Burns toast.
And I'm like, but he doesn't give the example on how it relates to burnt toast.
He doesn't really make a direct connection. And but I was like, the line right after that, he says, if things went a little differently, you know, I think he's basically saying, if you get to the point where you burn toast, there was probably one thing you could have done differently that didn't lead to you burning toast. Right?
Like, did he just compare a murder suicide to burning toast?
Yeah. Well, in this instance, it's like Danny opening the door to 237 is him, you know, turning the toaster on too long or whatever. Like, that, it's leading down the road of that burnt toast. But no, I love that little monologue. He's like, you know, some places are like people, some shine and some don't. It's such a great quote.
Yeah.
Like, that's a tombstone quote, like your epitaph right there. That's a brilliant fucking line.
There was something else about this scene that I was wanting to bring up. And I love how it's like, what's in room 237? And Scatman's pretty much just all like,
nothing. Plays very coy.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, nothing's in there, but don't you fucking go in that room. You understand?
I love when Danny's like, you're scared of 237, ain't you? And he's like,
no,
and he's clearly visibly scared.
Like, nah, dude.
That's what I'm saying, man. This movie's really funny.
You're scared of 237.
Right. Yeah, it's so good.
So I want to talk about Scatman because he's only in a few scenes.
Yeah.
Right after that, the next time we see him is when he gets the 911.
Yep.
Shining car, right?
Yep. And one of the best shots of the movie.
Yo, my man has the best artwork.
God, yeah.
In his room. Okay. Like, he has, and that's the reason I was like, dude, turn your hard drive back on and so I can watch this, because I was streaming it and they blurred it because it was like Comcast streaming service, whatever.
And it's such an innocuous fucking thing. It's just a painting of a girl's tits. Like, that's it.
It is a painting of beautiful naked black women. Like, and there's, and it starts there and it pans down because it's above, you're basically, the shot's going to lead to looking at the TV of a news broadcast, whatever. And the painting's above his TV. So it pans down from the wall, naked picture, shows the TV talking about the snowstorm, pans to Doc, who's laying in bed, and he has another one, which is massive.
Oh, no. Above his bed. I love that, like, you see Scatman, and yeah, they zoom out, and then you see the naked woman painting above his bed, and then they cut to his point of view from the TV, and then there's another painting of a different woman. It's so good.
Yeah.
If I was still living the bachelor life, I would have those paintings in my room. But absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
It'll have to be. It's not just a picture I'm going to frame, too. Like, someone had to paint this by hand, is what I want.
It's so great, man.
Someone took their time on this artwork. Great. But yeah, he gets the SOS call. Does his eyes, do they do an effect on his eyes when he, like, starts staring off real wide? Or is that just a lighting thing?
I think it's just a light. Like, I know what you're talking about. He kind of, his eyes almost like rumble out of his skull a little bit. Like,
well, no, it's like, it seems like, it's almost like, this sounds really shitty, but you know when dogs get like cataract and it's kind of like cloudy?
Yeah. I mean, that could just be old age as well. I mean, he's an older man, so. Right.
You know, but when he was in a certain angle, which, well, actually, no, it didn't even change angle. At one shot, when he's looking downwards towards the TV, I didn't notice it. So I was like, maybe his eyes, they do something with his eyes or something. And then he looks up towards the light when he's trying to, like, I guess he's talking to Danny at that point. It could just be the light, that because now he's looking at a bulb. It could just be playing with me. But
it's probably what it is. It's like probably a light right out of frame. Yeah, to give that look.
Because as far as special effects goes, I don't think there's a single special effect. I think everything is just practical.
Well, I mean, like, we talked about the bird's eye view of that hedge maze. That's technically a special effect. So there's probably some here and there for the most part. But yeah, I mean, this is a very bare bones movie.
Yeah. And I think that's minimalist. I think that's I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's why this movie's going to be timeless. This movie is definitely going to be timeless because it ages like a fine wine, man. Every time you see it, it gets better.
Look, that was 40 years ago. Okay. So CGI. Now, 40 years from now, the CGI we have now is going to look like shit.
Absolute dog shit. Man, this sucks. Absolute dog shit. Man, this is so frustrating. We're an hour and a half in already, and I still have so much I want to talk about. I just want to – let's – look, we've already talked about how great this movie is. I could be here for at least another 2 hours just talking about the movie.
Right.
There's something I noticed on this rewatch that I thought was really funny that I never noticed before. The guy that Dick calls to get the snowplow to borrow, the auto, like, rental guy.
Yeah, what was that whole scene thing? Like, what? It just seemed like a cut of him getting ready, him on a plane, him landing. It just seemed like a lot of unnecessary.
Here's what I never noticed. Did you notice the other patrons in this shop whenever the guy walks in to answer the phone and Dick's on the other line? The guy in the corner, like right into the front door, is just staring at this like swimsuit calendar. Like, there's no, he doesn't do anything. Like, the guy comes in to answer the phone, and this guy is just staring. It's so fucking weird.
I thought that was a cut. I thought it was just a picture. And I was like, maybe he's changing the...
No, that's what I thought, too. Maybe he's going to flip it to it's the wrong month or something. No, this dude's just staring.
Well, you know, when Jack is eating his lunch at the Overlook, or in the lobby, right at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's looking at a playgirl.
Yeah, he's looking at a playgirl. Yeah.
That's, and someone so pulled funny. Up that cover,
mm-hmm.
And they're the taglines on the set, or what do you? I don't know what you call them. Is like, I don't know, like Cosmopolitan. Be like, rate your sex game in this quiz or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, one of them is something like something about studies about parents sleeping with their kids.
Like yeah, something I did hear about that. Yeah. Like that. Yeah.
So there's a hint of not only was Jack physically abused, but sexually abused. But I was like, that's too subtle.
I think it's possible that maybe he abused Danny. I mean, it's possible. They never really get into it, into that. I mean, physically he did, clearly. But
I feel like, it, and this is just my opinion. I mean, I don't want to read too much into this, but if it was sexually, I feel like he would be more predatory towards Danny, but well, he seems completely separated.
There's that scene where he's in bed and Danny goes up to get his fire truck. That's really unsettling. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems. Yeah, but when I watched it, it seemed unsettling in the fact of, you know, Jack going crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like as far as like physical violence, not sexual violence.
Yeah.
But, you know, like even with my kid, like he'll walk in and say what's up in the mornings, like tell us good morning, but like come here and we just hang out for a second. Like,
yeah.
I guess it was unsettling because I know I'm watching a horror movie. Like, I don't want something bad to happen. But as far as the sexual, like, abuse, I didn't see any of that. I didn't see no hints of it or anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's – the seeds are there, but they never go any further past than that. Like, you could see it that way. You could interpret it that way. But I don't know if that's what Kubrick's trying to do or not. Let's get towards the ending because, like I said, we could be here all day. We haven't even talked about the subliminal messages in here, like the TV that doesn't have a power cord, or people entering a room and coming out like another place where they shouldn't physically be able to go. Like, there's a lot of great stuff like that. But
during the tour, they almost get hit by a car, and then it cuts to them. Yeah.
This is all stuff you like. If you're interested in like this stuff, there is some good things to get out of that room 237 doc, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But this movie, it gets better with every rewatch. You'll find new things to really love about it. But let's talk about the ending. So like you said, Danny does a shining call all the way from Colorado to Florida to Dick. Dick gets on a flight, comes out there to try and save them. He's murdered immediately. I love that we have to see him get the plane ticket, get on the airplane, rent the snowplow, drive through the snow, see that wrecked 18-wheeler and the Beetle, get all the way up there, and then within 12 seconds of walking in.
Yeah. Fucking God. Okay, so in that scene, that's where they climb. At that point, Danny is already out of the window from the bathroom.
Yep.
I don't know. I feel like my first instinct would not to be go right back into the house.
Yeah. But I mean, where's he going to go? But, like, he's going to die in the blizzard. I'm
thinking, like, he would die.
Yeah.
But from there, that's the only thing they heard Doc pulling up.
Yeah.
Jack leaves to go take care of Doc.
Yep.
So he is no longer trying to get in the bathroom. And Wendy can't fit through this little window.
Yep.
But the snow cat gets parked right outside that window. And you can't tell me that Wendy couldn't have waved down like, yo. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I think at that point, Dick was already inside and Wendy was like, I mean, think about what Wendy just went through. Like, her husband almost just axed through a door to kill her. Her son's out in a blizzard. Like, and something somebody pointed out too that I never really thought about, but when Jack is hacking through that bathroom door you know, and we see Wendy giving, Shelley Duvall giving the one of the best performances in a horror movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely phenomenal.
I mean, it's not intentional, but she raises her hand to like kind of cover her face a little bit. And you get a nice shot of her wedding ring. And it's like a reminder of like, dude, this is her husband.
Yeah.
Hacking through the door. The father of her child.
Yeah.
It's so fucking brilliant. Like,
but yeah, when Danny telepathed all the way from Colorado to Miami, watching it as a kid, I was like, yo, why is this kid like, I don't want to watch this kid have a seizure. Yeah. This is weird. Like,
it takes a lot of energy to get from Colorado to Florida, man.
Yeah, it didn't take it. Yeah, I didn't get that until now.
Yeah.
And this rewatch was, yo, he's about to like swallow his tongue because he's reaching out to.
It's a long distance call. Like, he's on roaming charges. Dude, it's that bill's going to be crazy.
Yeah, I'm.
No, I love the way they portray The Shining in this movie, where it's just subtle flashes of stuff. Like,
yeah, and it's not a foresight. Doc kind of talks about how like I can, you know, get feelings or something like that. It's not like he knows the future or anything like that. Because one of the biggest things about the movie is like, oh well, if Doc has The Shining, why didn't he see that axe coming?
Yeah. Well, that's what's so shitty about that miniseries is that like Doc's powers and those, like, everybody knows about it. Like, they like, Wendy's even like, hey, did Jack get the job? Yep, he's on his way now. Like, they do that a little bit in this movie, too, but, like, he doesn't talk to Wendy about it. He talks to Tony about it. And
yeah, it's Tony and Danny.
Yeah, Tony is telling Danny that he got the job.
It's not people just openly talking
it's so,
about,
like, yeah, that we'll talk powers. About the miniseries a little bit more in a bit, but, yeah, it's so bad.
Yeah. One thing I want to bring up, the use of mirrors in this movie.
Yeah.
Okay, I first noticed it in the scene where Wendy cooked Jack breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it cuts to her coming in the door, and the camera is stationary, so it just pivots around. She's like, yeah, talking about the eggs or whatever. And then the camera stays fixated on a mirror, which is angled at Jack laying in bed. He wakes up, you know, they have a nice conversation. A good 30 seconds of this one still shot looking into a mirror.
Yep.
Okay. I thought it was phenomenal. I was like, that's a really cool shot. Wrote it down in my notes. Next. After Wendy told Jack that a woman in 237 choked Danny, he goes to check it out. She's panicking in the room. He knocks on the door to say that, you know, no one was there.
Mm-hmm.
The hallway or the door is like in a little corridor thing. So it's kind of like a hallway leading to the door.
Yeah.
There on the, if you were opening the door on your left, there's a mirror stationed there.
Yep.
Okay. And then when she opens the door, again, Jack's head. Like, it's uses of mirrors and stuff like that is absolutely phenomenal. Again, shout out to Mom. I was talking to her about that on the phone earlier, and I was telling her about, like, yeah, there's something about it. And I think you told me this a long time ago on how the movie can be played backwards at the same time as forwards or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know how much I buy into that theory, but I see where you're going.
I was giving her a brief description of it. I was like, yeah, the thing, like, it mirrors itself. And she was like, yeah, and it's playing the same forward as it is backwards, kind of like Red Rum, right? And I was like,
yeah.
Holy shit, Mom. And the big play in the mirrors, I've noticed the amazing shots so far strategically done by them, and then really hits home when the whole Red Rum reveal when she sees it in the mirror.
Mm.
And I just thought that's something to be talked about.
Well, it's a great moment. Like, when she, you know, Red Rum is not really a big thing in this movie. It's, I mean, it is, but it's not all over the movie. It's really that one scene. And like, you know, in the miniseries, it's a little more played up. But I love that it's like, as soon as she reads it, it's murder. We do that snap zoom in. The score that I was talking about that I love, the little like wood block or whatever that is that plays, kicks in. And right then is when Jack starts hacking through the door. Like, it's that's the starting part of the climax.
The kicker.
It's right there.
This shit's about to kick off, yeah.
Anyways, let's get back to this. So Dick comes in through the front door, the Overlook. Jack kills him. Danny screams in horror as Dick's getting killed. And then what I call my favorite shot in all of cinema history is that slow motion shot of Jack Nicholson just rising up with the evilest fucking look I've ever seen.
Yes. And the blood on his bald spot so from Wendy.
Fucking good. But he chases Danny through the hotel and eventually out to the hedge maze. Wendy seeing all the ghosts and crazy shit, the blood elevator. The one thing I find kind of silly is like the cobwebs and the skeletons that she sees.
That didn't make sense to me, but
it just felt very Scooby-Doo-ish to me.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? Anyways, Jack's chasing him, chasing Danny through the hedge maze. Danny eventually realizes he can cover his tracks and get out of there. And the whole time, Jack is just getting further and further, like, deteriorated in cognitive thought. Like, he's almost getting to the point where he's just, like, an animal. Like, it's just primal screaming. He's not even saying words anymore.
Yeah, he developed a limp from the falling down the stairs.
Yeah,
he in a head wound.
Had his hand slashed by the kitchen knife.
Yeah, so he is just this like he's curling over himself with this axe, chasing his 5-year-old son
through a blizzard,
to chop him up with an axe. Yeah. I mean, in the middle of a blizzard. Yeah. You know what? Even worse, in the middle of a hedge maze.
In a hedge maze, in a blizzard, on a bump on a log. Like
I'll take a blizzard any day.
Danny manages to get out. Him and Wendy get in the snowcat that Dick brought and escape. Jack crumbles to the snow, screaming in anger or horror or confusion, whatever you want to call it. And then
amazing transition.
Hard cut. Like
just a hard cut to daytime.
And one of the creepiest images of all time, just frozen dead Jack Nicholson with like a cannibalistic, early caveman just lowered brow look on his face. Like he's dead.
It's you've seen the image, and if not, like it's so iconic.
Yeah.
I like the quick snap because this movie really uses timestamps a lot. Yeah. Like it'll say a month later or Tuesday. It doesn't even tell you how long it's been, just Tuesday. For this not to do that, and they just cut to...
Oh, it's a hard cut, too, and you get that little, like, fluttering key stinger. It's so fucking good.
It'll definitely give you chills.
Yeah. And then final shot of the movie is a slow push into this framed photo on the wall inside the hotel of the Overlook Hotel celebrating, I think it's New Year's Eve, 1921, maybe?
1921. It was a 4th of July.
4th of July, you're right. A party that we're having in the Gold Room, and you realize the face of the patron in the very front of the photo is Jack Nicholson. So it's implied.
But another thing about it, so Jack's had the same hairstyle. He seems to be cleaned up a little bit more. A
lot more cleaned up.
Like is this is it a different time?
So here's my thing. I think there's a couple of different ways you can look at this ending. I've always took it as Jack is now a part of the hotel and that he wasn't in that picture originally. And now that he's dead, he is in that – he's trapped in the Overlook. I could also see it as Jack Torrance that we see in this movie is a reincarnation of himself from an earlier time. And he's just in this endless cycle, you know, of
– like a limbo.
Yeah. Thing. Like, that's – I mean there's – you can see it either way. I've always took it as the former, but I don't come down hard on one side or the other.
Yeah, and I think
– and it's ambiguous intentionally. Like, it's not definitive.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, it's meant to be use your imagination. It's up to your interpretation of what it is.
Yeah.
Personally, I think – I don't know. This is also something I picked up on the watch. Jack mentions how it's weird when he first got here. He mentioned something. I can't remember the exact dialogue.
He says I felt like I knew what was going to be around every corner.
Exactly. He'd always been there. It seems like he's been here, right?
Yeah.
And then as under the influence of the ghost or whatever, the hotel, whatever, it gets a little crazier. So at this point, you think he's just talking mad, like crazy shit, right?
Yeah.
But when he sets Danny down, he's like, I love this place. I wish we can live here forever and ever.
Yep.
And then when Wendy wants to leave, he is insulted.
Yeah.
Like he's like absolutely too far gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's like, has he been here before? You got that vibe, and then the picture did everything but confirm that. You know what I mean? Yeah. It just kind of seemed like... yeah, exactly. I think it's just supposed to be cut and dry. Leave it to what you want it to be.
Gotcha.
I actually talked to my mom about this, and she took it as exactly what you said. People that die, the hotel itself is haunted. It's not just a Jack thing, because what about the Grady family? What made him kill his family?
Yeah.
Type thing. If it was just Jack, then... that plot wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
My mom thinks it's the hotel is cursed, haunted, whatever. The manager did say people think it was built on a burial ground Native or American, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she thinks the hotel itself is haunted. And the picture, the 1921 4th of July thing, is just people that's been killed there.
Yeah.
But I was like, I didn't see the little girls. And she was like, well, it was an adult party. Maybe they weren't. I was like, eh, I guess.
I mean, Dr. Sleep gets into it a little bit more as to what exactly is happening there. But I don't want to spoil it too much. Before we get to Silver Linings and stuff like that, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about two more things. And I know there's so much we didn't get to, but like I said, we could be here forever. Maybe we'll have to do a part two at some point. But the scene where we see the all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. That whole scene is so fucking incredible because it manages to make me terrified and make me laugh hysterical at the same time. And the part that I laugh at, it's not supposed to be funny, but you know, Jack's like, you think you're concerned for Danny's health. And Wendy's like, yes. And you think we should take him to a hospital? Yes. And just when do you think we should take him to a hospital? And she says, as soon as possible. And the way he mocks her back with, as soon as possible. It's not supposed to be funny, but man, it gets me every time.
It's so childish.
It's so, so petty. But the part I was going to say that scene that grows on me more and more every time is, you know, it's obviously Jack Nicholson's giving a great performance. Shelley Duvall in that scene is out fucking standing. And the part that really sticks out to me is when she says,
I just want to go back to my room.
Why?
Well, I'm very confused. I just need a chance to think things over.
It's soul crushing.
Because She came down here saying we need to take our son to a doctor.
Yeah.
And she is so terrified and so broke down that she just wants to go back to her room.
Well,
she wants to obey. Like, I'll leave you alone. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I mean, that's where you can get into the whole, like, this movie's about abusive relationships or toxic masculinity or whatever.
Controlling,
Stockholm Syndrome, whatever you want to call it. But, like, the fucking audacity of anyone that says the character of Wendy is stupid or pathetic. It's this woman has been in an abusive relationship that's clearly been occurring well before the hotel. And Duvall has to do this thing where she's playing a victim of emotional and verbal abuse, but maybe even physical abuse. We don't know. And she also
has
this
still a mother.
Yeah. She's trying her best to keep this family together, but she also has like this subtle hint of like a naivety, like she's almost like a gullible aunt at some times, like, you know, like maybe not your mom necessarily, but someone in your family.
Oh my god, yes. And I actually have a note on that. I did look, there's one scene in this movie I'm like, you're so fucking stupid, and it's right there at the beginning when Danny passes out brushing his teeth, right?
Yeah.
Okay, this doctor, I don't know, there's no dialogue on them saying like, oh yeah, this lady's been our doctor for years, but
yeah,
she just sits at the
table.
Boy,
do you remember when doctors made house calls? Holy shit.
Right? What's up with that? Yeah. But she just sits down, like this kid passed out brushing his teeth.
Yeah.
Jack's not even there, but she feels the need to sit down and have a cigarette with her at the kitchen table and tell her how Jack had a drinking problem and ripped his son's arm out of the socket to a doctor that, as far as we know, she just met.
Yeah.
Now, taking that back, Dustin, if I can change anything about this movie, it would be that scene. Not the passing out from brushing teeth, but just that me as the audience, I didn't want to know about the whole incident with the alcohol in the shoulder. I felt like it would have hit harder because just knowing that, you know, when Wendy reacted saying, "You did this," when he obviously didn't, talk about the marks on his face and stuff.
Yeah.
And then cut, and then at the bar scene with Lloyd, and he goes on that monologue, and that's as the audience, we find out that, yo, he had a drinking problem and he hurt Danny really bad.
Yeah.
That's I can why see that. She accused him. I just felt like that it would have just hit way no, harder because that scene kind of agree with you. So much.
I definitely see where you're coming from. The only thing that I would keep in, the only reason why I would say you do keep that doctor scene is it plays up more into the nonsensical timeline in this movie. And what I mean by that is she says when she's talking to the doctor, this happened like 5 months ago. You know, when he ripped Danny's...
Well, no, it happened 3 years ago, but he hasn't been drinking.
Well, no, she says it happened 5 months ago, and he stopped drinking then. He says it happened 3 years ago.
Oh.
So there's... It plays into more of this, you know, you don't know the full story. And they do that with, like... The subliminal stuff, like we talked about, with like rooms that architecturally don't make sense and like timelines right. and stuff like that's why I say you kind of keep it in, just because like it really plays into the mystery of everything. Like, you know, you're almost like a voyeur in the hotel watching all this happen. You're not getting the full story. But that being said, I do see where you're coming from, that it would have made more sense and hit harder for Jack to tell that part. But I also like that you get both sides of that story. That's what she saw and that's what he saw.
Yeah.
She saw it as that was the day my husband like realized he had a drinking problem and he got better. Jack sees it as that was like the downfall of our relationship. You know?
Yeah. Also, it's playing back on the we talked about the American dream type thing. And if listeners out there, you've been in arguments with your boyfriend, girlfriend, it's always a he said, she said,
yep.
all this stuff. She sees it. Basically, there's things that she'll when Jack says she'll never let me forget it.
Yeah.
She's going to bring up something that happened years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, it was something pretty fucking serious, but okay. You know,
yep.
it happened. We moved on. It just kind of plays on that, that they're not okay. You know what I mean? They're not okay. It's the, like I said, it's the American dream relationship thing, just completely upside down
yep.
and the worst it could possibly be.
Yeah. Well, real quick, the last one thing I want to talk about before we get into the silver linings and all that is, we mentioned it before, but the deleted ending of this movie. So this movie had a different ending when it went to theaters.
It's pretty lackluster. I mean, it's nothing.
It's nothing that, you know, crazy, but I do see why they removed it. You know, after its premiere, you know, the movie's in theaters for about a week into its theatrical run. Kubrick decides he wants to cut the end of the movie. So he has to take these reels back, cut it, and put it back into theaters, which is kind of crazy. But basically, the scene is just like, it shows Wendy and Doc at the hospital having escaped, and Ullman shows up and says they couldn't find Jack's body. But then he also gives Danny the yellow tennis ball that Jack was using at the hotel, like bouncing around and stuff, and gives it to Danny.
Right.
So, I mean, like I said, I get why it was cut out. It's, you don't really need that. It's the way they play it is much better with the ambiguous photo on the wall than, oh, nobody was ever found. Like, that's almost like a campfire story way of
yeah.
ending your movie. Like, ooh. Yeah, exactly. He might as well hold a flashlight yeah. up to his face and go, ooh. But, yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a print of it. I've seen still photos of it, but I've never seen the actual scene.
I've seen still photos,
yep. but
honestly, I think that gives us too much.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, even when you look at a broad spectrum, like, that's not giving us anything at all.
It's not giving you anything you need. Like, we don't need to know that Jack's body, quote unquote, was never found. And, you know, it's much scarier to you get. It's weird. It's a movie where you watch the villain die, and yet it's still scary.
Yeah, you're still terrified.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And it, yeah.
Let's talk about one other piece of trivia I wanted to talk about that I don't know if you got this in your research too, but I didn't know about this until this researcher for this.
Something too.
The all work and no play the pages. I think most people that know anything about this movie know that that was all real typed out pages. Like, it wasn't just Xerox, because you can see, like,
yeah, it had different formats and different
typos and stuff like that.
Typos, yeah. And stuff.
But for the international versions of this film, there were different languages translated.
Different languages.
So,
well, yeah, translated. It was German, Italy, and
I have the German, the French, the Spanish, and the Italian right here.
Okay, read them out.
The German one translated to "Never put off till tomorrow what may be done today," which I feel like is a pretty good one. It kind of falls in line with the same theme that All Work and No Play does. The French
the writer's block stuff.
Yeah. The French version is kind of weird. It's one, here you go, is worth more than two, you'll have it.
I don't get it.
With, apparently, that's a French phrase. It's kind of similar to a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Yeah. The Spanish version was, no matter how early you get up, you can't make the sun rise any sooner, which is also kind of eerie. Like, I like that one.
Yeah.
But by far the strangest one is the one that was Italian, which is "the morning has gold in its mouth." I don't know what that's supposed to translate to, like, in terms of, like, an idiom, but very strange. Anyway, that's the trivia I had.
Yeah, before I forget this, not that scene, but the scene, the interaction before where he's finally started typing, she comes in talking about going for a walk or something like that.
Yeah.
He's talking about getting distracted. Jack Nicholson actually wrote that scene.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's a great scene.
He basically, at the time, of course, he was acting, but he was also doing a lot of writing, and he related so much to finally being on track and then, you know, just being that exhausted and finally getting there. But you can't stop because you're finally in the groove.
Yeah.
And you just lash out. And I can
attest to that. Like, not that I've ever, like, physically or verbally, like, lashed out like that, but you do feel like, especially screenwriting, like, you get when you're in that groove and you're going and someone breaks your concentration or, like, you know, you have to stop to do something. It is gut, like, it physically is painful. Like, it really hurts.
It's so bad. Like, I'll be in mid sentence or something like that, though. If someone talks about something that wasn't related to what I was saying, it's all gone. I have no idea what I was saying. And you've heard it in this podcast, actually, guys. That's
JT is just seething the whole time.
Yeah, like Danny trying to talk to Doug in Miami.
Well, one last thing before we get to Silver Linings. We have to do this because this movie's got so many different options. We got to talk about Prop Cop.
Oh, God. Yeah, we do.
So I have so many things I want from this movie. So many things. It's hard for me to pick one. But I tell you what, I'm going to let you go first because I want you to take whatever you take. I want you to take it off the table for me so I don't have that as an option.
Okay, so this is going to sound weird. Okay, it might not be the ideal prop cop. In the movie, Danny's wearing this Mickey Mouse sweater thing, and it's a football one.
Yeah.
Fucking, oh, mint.
Yep. His sweater game is awesome in this movie.
I can't remember if it was me or my brother. The color, it was different color. It was kind of, there's only two colors on that sweater. It was different color than that, but we actually had that sweater.
That's awesome.
Remember, it was either.
Dude, I miss those custom knit sweaters. I had a Ninja Turtles one when I was a kid. Bro, that was awesome.
I remember, I think Shay still has your, like, second grade picture where you had that your foot propped up and your sweater game is on point.
The Ninja Turtle Jordans, as I like to call it.
Like, sweater. Jesus.
No. So you want the sweater? That's
dude,
awesome.
I would love to have the sweater again.
So we talked about one of the things I wanted. I wanted the Dick Halloran paintings in his bedroom.
Yeah.
But that's not what I'm going to pick for the episode because I went through so many different things. I wanted that. I wanted the maze model on the table that Jack looks at because I just think that's awesome.
The tennis ball.
The tennis ball, the Playgirl that Jack's reading, Wendy's baseball bat. There's so many good things. I ultimately had to come down on the that's it. Like, the thing of this movie, and that is the axe.
Yeah.
Jack's axe. It's I love that they played homage to it too in like Breaking Bad. They had the same, well, a similar axe to that.
Yeah.
It's that's for some reason you don't see a lot of silver like plated axes. You know what I mean?
Usually it's red so, for fire and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird too because in the movie you get close ups of it kind of when he's chopping through the door. It's not that sharp.
No.
Like it's well, but it's I such think a that's good
also with again with Jack going through 60 doors. They were like, yo, file this thing down.
Very good point. Can we? But yeah, I ultimately came down on the axe. It's just, you gotta take it, man.
Yeah, okay,
you gotta take it.
Another, I don't know. You think about it and like, I don't know. There's not much else that just stands out except for the items we just listed. Nothing that would just.
I mean, I can think of a lot of stuff. Honestly, the glass that he drinks the whiskey out of is great.
I thought about just the snow cat. I just want a snow cat.
One whole snow cat.
Just the whole one. Yeah.
Hello again, it's me. Real quick, Dustin Goes Hollywood. Just want to let you know that's the end of part one of our discussion on The Shining. If you want to hear part two, stay tuned. It'll be dropping soon in your feed sometime this week. We really hope you enjoyed part one, and we hope to see you again in part two.
Excelsior!
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 Excelsior! Oh. Look it up!